Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
An Erios Original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today, we'll be speaking with guest expert John Farragher, professor of history and American studies at Yale University, specializing in Western and frontier history. He's also the author of Eternity Street, Violence and Justice in Frontier Los Angeles. And make sure to look out for his upcoming book, California, A Short History, coming out spring of 2022. Let's hear what he has to say about the Chinese Massacre of 1871.
Hi, Professor Farragher. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, Rebecca. Thank you.
So could you start off by giving us a quick rundown of what Los Angeles was like pre-Gold Rush? Who inhabited the area and what was it like?
Pre-Gold Rush. Okay, well, Los Angeles was founded as a Spanish pueblo in 1781. This was part of the Spanish effort to colonize Alta California. They had already established settlements and mostly missions in Baja California, but they were pressed to move further north because they were fearful of the encroachment of the Russians, who had established sea otter hunting traders in what we now call Alaska and were pushing south. And the British, who were with the Hudson's Bay Company, who had also pushed across the continent and gotten to the Pacific. So the Spanish, who had just participated in the Seven Years' War on the losing side, during which the British conquered, the British invaded and seized Manila and Havana, Cuba, Manila in the Philippines and Havana, Cuba, their most important international ports, the Spanish's most important international ports. They were scared that the British or the Russians would move down and occupy Alta California. So they developed this colonization plan, we briefly stated, was a mission plan to send Franciscan missionaries into California, establish missions, convert the native people to Christians and teach them to labor at the missions so that the colony could be self-supporting. The whole idea was that native labor would support the colony. And then they would also develop pueblos for settlers. And Los Angeles was one of those. Los Angeles, San Jose, Santa Cruz were the original pueblos. But that plan aborted because the Spanish had hoped to establish an overland route from what is now basically Tucson or northern Sonora province across the desert to California. To do that, they had to cross at the Colorado River, which was controlled by the Quichan, sometimes called the Yuma native people. They revolted against the Spanish and closed the river crossing. And so the Spanish were never able to colonize California effectively. But the missionaries and the small population of the Pueblos was all that really was of the colony colonization attempt. By the 1840s, the missions had been what they call secularized, converted to private property. The native converts had been forcibly converted into an agrarian labor force for the rancheros. And Los Angeles was deep into the production of grapes for wine. The major industry in Los Angeles was wine production. And actually in 1846, the governor of California, Pio Pico, lived in Los Angeles. There was a lot of conflict between Los Angeles and the South and Monterey and the North, the Californios, the native, the settlers of the Spanish settlers. Mexico broke away from Spain in 1821. So California was no longer associated with Spain, but it was part of, it was a territory of Mexico.
When the Chinese, when Chinese immigrants begin to arrive in gold country around 1840s, how were they received and what drew them out here initially?
Well, they actually arrived in the 1850s. By 1852, when California conducted its first really comprehensive census, the Chinese were the largest single ethnic group other than American citizens in California. So they came in beginning about 1850, and that migration accelerated through the 50s into the 60s and into the early 70s. So the first Chinese in Los Angeles arrived sometime probably during the Civil War, maybe about 1862. By 1870, when the federal census is taken, the Chinese population of Los Angeles is officially 234. There probably were a lot of people missed in that. So, you know, I think a good guess is 350 Chinese in Los Angeles, perhaps in 1870. Now, they basically came in to replace native workers who had who were the major labor force in Los Angeles and the surrounding countryside, but were suffering greatly from epidemic disease. There was a big smallpox epidemic in Los Angeles during the Civil War, and thousands of native people perished in that epidemic. So Los Angeles, after the Civil War, was beginning to develop. The old ranchos were being divided up into farms. A railroad was built connecting downtown Los Angeles with San Pedro. So it was a kind of what we call the first Los Angeles boom, late 1860s. And so there were a lot of new people moving in, a lot of disruption of old ways. And the Chinese were really basically there to pick up the slack from native labor, which was had been decimated in the smallpox pandemic. So the Chinese picked up all the adverse negative stereotype that went with the attitude about native people, so they came in two strikes against them.
So I read that Los Angeles had higher homicide rates per capita than New York City and Chicago. How violent of a city was it at that time period?
Well, it left Chicago. Chicago was really not much of a city at all at that time. Of course, New York was. It had a population approaching a million. But the Los Angeles homicide rate was, you know, astronomically higher than New York's. You know, homicide rates are calculated usually as how many homicides per 100,000 people. So, you know, when you get the number that it's this number in a population of 100,000, the rates in New York were around 30 per 100,000. Now that would make New York about as violent as the most violent American cities today. I don't know who the winner of that booby prize is this year, but it's usually places like East St. Louis or New Orleans or someplace like, you know, those rates are usually around 50 per 100,000. In the early 1850s, Los Angeles had a rate of 560.
Wow.
So it had a rate of homicide 10 times greater than the most violent cities today. That rate, 560, which prevailed in the early 1850s, is a little bit like low-scale warfare. A rate like that means is that literally everyone in the population of Los Angeles either had experienced violence as a victim, as a perpetrator, or as a bystander. There was no way to avoid it. And so, yes, Los Angeles, there was only one place in California that had a higher homicide rate, and that was the Mariposa County in the Southern Sierras, where there was an enormous amount of conflict between ethnic groups over mining claims and where lynch law prevailed. But other than that, Los Angeles takes the prize. Probably, I would think we don't have a comprehensive list of statistics for cities in the 1850s or 60s. But from what I can garner from what we do know, I would hazard the guess that Los Angeles, if not the most violent place in the nation, was on a list of the top five.
So with such high crime rates, why were there only six policemen in the 1870s?
By 1871, there were seven.
Oh, not, wow.
And they were called the law enforcement official in Los Angeles in 1871 was the city marshal. And he had deputy marshals. He had 77 deputy marshals. That had just been raised from five a year before. And people thought, wow, now we're safe. at seven, but violence was so pronounced right at the beginning. You know, American conquest is the war of the Mexican-American War is 1846 to 1848. The United States troops and the rebels from the Bear Flag Republic took possession of Los Angeles from the Californios. In 1849, January 1849, I mean, I'm sorry, 1847, California became a state in 1850. And during that interregnum period between 1847 and 1850, there was essentially no government at all. The Mexican government had been destroyed by the war, its officials exiled. There were no authorities. A small number of occupying troops, but they did not play a role as police. So the violence is a product of that era, with no governance and no law enforcement. There were no courts. There were no sheriffs. There were no marshals. There was nothing. And yet we were in the middle of a conquest, middle of a conflict that was extraordinarily violent, and yet there was no remedy. And so throughout California, and in Los Angeles in particular, what was known as popular justice, which we would today call lynch law, was the established conventional method of trying to put a cap on violent crime. The problem with popular justice is that it knows no bounds. There are no guardrails on popular justice, and it easily gets out of hand. It is toxic. But Los Angeles, basically, popular justice was its mother's milk in the late 1840s and through the 1850s. And by 1855, there's an incident in Los Angeles, an incident in which lynch law prevails over the efforts of the local judge to establish a procedure of law and order. And from 1855 until 1871, when the Chinese massacre takes place, essentially a vigilante committee, the Committee of Vigilance, what they called the VC, basically was the predominant institution of law and order in Los Angeles. Whenever people felt that violent crime was getting out of hand, there would be a series of lynchings. They would take prisoners to jail and lynch them, not allow the courts to try them. Even in some cases, they broke into courts and removed the accused from the court and lynched them.
Wow.
This became the conventional way of doing law and order in Los Angeles.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Chinese community that had settled in downtown? I know that they were about 350. How were they being portrayed by the local publication, and why?
I think the first thing, we should say something about the community itself. It was a transient community of Chinese. Most of these people had only been there at most a year or two. It was almost entirely male. Very few Chinese women came over from China. And those who did, 90% of those who did, when they got to California, became prostitutes. They were almost certainly the victims of human trafficking, kidnapped, sold into slavery by their impoverished families. So there were a few dozen women in Los Angeles, but nearly all of them were prostitutes. So this was not what you call a solid community, the Chinese community of Los Angeles in 1871. It was transient. It had more the feeling of like a lot of California did, of a kind of a, you know, it had the feeling of a mining camp. Nothing seemed permanent. The Chinese moved into the oldest quarter of Los Angeles, which Anglo residents called along a street called Negro Alley, which is just if you visit the plaza downtown in Los Angeles, there's an old fire station. You turn the corner from the fire station, you're on Negro Alley. There is a plaque on the street there in the sidewalk commemorating the riot, the massacre. It's very hard to find and hard to read when you do find it, but it's there, and it would give you a sense of, you know, the locale. So Chinatown developed on that east side of the plaza. Of course, there was no Union Station. It just sort of slopes down there to the river. And so there were lots of shacks and old adobes and old wooden construction. And Chinatown stayed there until they built Union Station and cleared Chinatown away. And and opened what they call New Chinatown north of the plaza, where you know, Los Angeles' Chinatown is now, which was all a construction moving people out of their homes and into new quarters in New Chinatown. So, you know, the Chinese came in. The workers were transient. A lot of them came in for a few months and they would leave. So there was not much stability in the community. The Anglo community treated them like pariahs. Like I said, they picked up all the prejudice that was directed at the native people because they filled their roles. They were vineyard workers and they were ranch workers, and also they did their own particular had their own particular economic interests. They ran laundries. There was a Chinese cigar manufacturing establishment downtown. But the Anglo reception of the Chinese was hostile from the very beginning. The newspapers published scurrilous articles about the bestial Chinese, about their filthy dens, about opium smoking, which, by the way, many Anglos did. There was a lot of slumming went on. The population, the white population of Los Angeles was also predominantly male. So a lot of men, a lot of white men frequented Chinese brothels and patronized Chinese prostitutes. A lot of them, Chinese gambling, which was a big deal, was very popular. And Anglos, became fanatic about the numbers and other forms of Chinese gambling. But the beginning at the height of this building boom I was discussing before in the late 1860s, suddenly there began to be in the court record occurrences of anti-Chinese violence. From 1869 to 1871, before the massacre, there are, I counted 20 separate incidents of anti-Chinese violence, usually unprovoked. It's just an Asian person, a Chinese person being attacked on the streets. I mean, very familiar.
Yeah, sadly, yes.
But they seem to come out of nowhere in 1869 and multiply over the next 2 years as a prelude to the massacre itself. So the Chinese were hated. They were scorned. They were seen as dirty and corrupt. And this was not just true about Los Angeles, but California in general. I mean, 90% of all the Chinese in the country lived in California. But Los Angeles has the dubious fame, or infamy, really, of being the site of the first mass violence against the Chinese.
And speaking of that, could you give us a quick recap on what happened October 24th, 1871? How it all went down?
It was the Chinese, as they were almost all male, and they were organized into what are known as companies. These were really benevolent associations based on residence in China. They were like in the 20th century, when there were a lot of immigrants from the Midwest came to Los Angeles, they would have like Iowa Day picnics and South Dakota Day picnics and Nebraska picnics for all the immigrants. But this was the same kind of thing. These companies were based on the region you came from in China. So based on your region, you would join that particular company. And they helped people out with travel money. They was a place to go and relax. But they also included a lot of vice, drugs, and prostitution. And the conflict began between basically Chinese brothel owners who were competing for the business, the John business. And they had several incidents of violence, but the one on the 24th ended up wounding three Angelinos, two white men. One white man, one white man and two Californios. The Californios survived. The white man died. And because these people were caught in the crossfire, and once a white man was shot by these Chinese gangsters, they were essentially gangsters, sometimes they're called highbinders. The population downtown, the white population from that area, went nuts and besieged the Chinese in their quarters along Negro Alley. So that's the way it starts. That its explosion into a catastrophe is really a responsibility of the very bad decisions made by the small number of law enforcement officials in Los Angeles. Because instead of trying to break up, at first there was 20, 30, 40 men, white men, shooting into the houses of Chinese on Negro Alley. So what they could have done at that point was use their policing power, which was very slender, I admit, seven deputy marshals and like a call on the county sheriff who had his office in Los Angeles as well. He was there. He had a couple of deputies. So altogether, they could have maybe mustered 10, 12 men. And the appropriate law enforcement procedure then would be to break up the crowd who's firing indiscriminately mm-hmm. into homes. But they didn't do that. They deputized the mob.
Wow.
But they gave them the power of the authority of law. And then it was all over. So then people started coming from wow. all over, white men from all over the city, and joined the mob. So by the end of it, we've got 200-400 people besieging Chinatown because the law enforcement that was there bungled it so badly.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, if you had to pick one person or thing, it could be a concept that is to blame for the Chinese massacre of 1871, then who or what would that be? I have a feeling I might know, but I would like to hear it from you.
I don't think I could. To tell you the truth, I don't think I could pick one. I can give you a, because you can't really isolate a single factor.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt that there was a lot of, you know, anti-Asian Orientalism kind of prejudice. There's no doubt about that. There also was the contempt that people had for those who filled that slot in the labor system, the slot that had been formerly filled by Native people. The Chinese, as I said, moved into that slot. They picked up all the scorn that went with that role. It was also a we're living in 1871 within 25 years of the conquest of California by the United States. Back when California was conquered by the United States, they were less than a century into the era of Spanish colonization, which exploited the native people. So an attitude of superiority, colonial superiority, and native or, sort of proletarian subservience, what I would call the legacy of conquest, was a prevailing cultural ethic. So you put, and then, you know, there are other factors, the availability of guns, the tradition of violence, the history of vigilantism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a man had been lynched in 1870, December 1870, less than a year before. He had been taken from the jail and lynched. He was a murderer. He was a bad man, no doubt, but they didn't give him the chance to stand trial.
Right.
The county judge ordered a grand jury to look into who had done the deed. Everybody knew who had done it. It was an open and shut case. People marched to the jail. The leaders were listed in the paper. Everybody knew, but the jury did what the grand jury always did. And said that the lynching had been committed by people or persons unknown. When the Chinese massacre began, it took all the shape of another lynching. The first man who was killed was taken up to the spot where the man had been lynched 10 months before and lynched him there.
Wow.
And while they were there, a businessman in Los Angeles who objected to what was going on confronted one of the lynchers, and he was told, and the man who's he was confronting one of the lynchers, and this guy was a member of the vigilance committee, the guy who's asking the question. He says, "Why are you doing this? This is disruptive. This is terrible." And the man turned to him, knowing who he was speaking to, and said, "We're all vigilantes now." So that tradition of vigilantism was, I think, the determining factor in turning what could have been you know, a rather low scale riot into a cataclysm in which 18 Chinese men lost their lives.
Okay, well, we're going to have to discuss this now. Thank you so much, Professor Farragher, for joining us today and helping us get to the bottom of who's to blame for the Chinese massacre of 1871.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you, Rebecca.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With us today, we have producer Amanda Lund.
Hello, Rebecca. Hello, Alarmy.
And fact checker Chris Smith.
Hello, everyone. And hello, Amanda. You never say hello to me.
Well, because one time I did say hello to you and you said I spoiled it.
I'd have to go back.
The big surprise. Fact checker Chris is here.
The archives. I don't believe you. That just doesn't seem like it's of my character. But anyway, I digress.
So, I mean, how about all of that information coming from Professor Farragher? I mean, I was gasping. I was like, uh-huh.
Yeah, that was
that
was very Michael Barbaro of you, where you were like responding in real time as the information was coming out. But there were some pretty incredible tidbits that he dropped.
Yes, the legacy
and the history of Los Angeles.
I know.
Oh, yes. Fantastic. Yes. I mean, I did say to him after we stopped recording, I was like, I'm second generation Californian. And so I need to learn about all this stuff. So I'm definitely going to read his books. And I also real quick just want us to take a minute because he talked about something really interesting after we stopped recording, but I did catch it on Zoom. So I'm going to just plug that in here real quick, just about the connection to the Civil War and Reconstruction. So take a listen to this.
In the late 1860s. Think about what's going on. The Civil War has just ended. We're in Reconstruction. The United States has passed the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, the 14th Amendment establishing due process of law and equal protection of the laws and birthright citizenship. The 15th Amendment has established voting rights for people regardless of sex or not sex, regardless of race or previous condition of servitude. California refused to ratify the 14th Amendment. California ratified the 14th and 15th Amendment in 1959. So, and in the campaign, when, you know, because the campaign was, you know, the 14th and 15th Amendments had to be ratified by vote of the legislature. And so I recently was reading the newspapers for that vote, you know, surrounding that vote. So a newspaper in Sonoma says you can't vote for this amendment because if you give black people their rights, that's not a problem. There are not enough black people in California to care about, but it'll extend to the Chinese. And that we cannot tolerate. Why can't we tolerate it? Because we cannot give up on the principle, and here, get ready for it, of white supremacy.
Okay, we're back.
I mean, of course, like in 1959, this didn't get passed until 1959. That is, I'm really bad at math, but 62 years? I mean, if you're over 60, then you live through that.
You know, it's especially so interesting when you think of how California today is seen as this sort of vanguard of progressivism and sort of civil rights in certain ways, and how how the history of that is just it's sort of more of a modern conception than anything else.
Right. I mean, the 70s or the late 60s and 70s like really turned it around, I guess, in many ways, but clearly not in enough ways. There's still so much work to be done.
Just to remind us and our alarmy, we sent xenophobia to jail and we slapped the local Los Angeles government, which is kind of interesting. But after talking to Professor Farragher, are you thinking about changing the verdict?
Well, I just loved the legacy of conquest as a contributing factor to this situation. The way that he explained, you know, what he explained about how white supremacy, you know, needed to be above it all, like their need to always have to be superior, right? And to have people underneath, right? Which is conquest.
Yeah. I mean, he really threw out like he was like firing off keywords that I was just scribbling down. So he said, and these are all amazing to have in our back pocket for future episodes. As we know, these concepts come up a lot, but the attitude of colonial superiority, proletarian subservience, I know, the legacy of conquest, and the tradition of vigilantism, which I think we were all saying wrong that entire episode.
Also, it's like the way he put it, the tradition of vigilantism.
Yes.
I also want to point out, he mentioned that we kept saying 1971 in the episode. And yes, if we said 1971, I apologize. It definitely happened in 1871.
Oh, no.
But he said that we were saying 19 people lynchings. Died.
Oh.
Or was it, right? He was saying it was something like 18 people died.
Yes, he said there were 18
lynchings. We got the number wrong. I see. So he said it was 19. We kept saying 19 instead of 18. I thought he was talking about the year, but
no, but sounds like us.
Exactly. Yeah. I wouldn't put it past us. Okay. Apologize. Apologies. It was 18, not 19. There are, in all fairness, there are so many differing accounts online, and there isn't like a super cohesive, like, okay, this is what happened. And we got to read these books because I'm so interested in the history of California now. It's such an interesting state.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. And, you know, we growing up in California, our big fourth grade project was all about the missions. Mm. And so we each got assigned a mission and we had to build them in any way we saw fit. So of course, grew up with an older sister who was very talented artistically. So she built mine. She would always do my artistic projects. I got, I think mine was called like La Pisma. It was pink, if I remember correctly. But anyway, we learned all about the missions. I went to Catholic school, I should say, and nothing about, you know, sort of the collateral damage coming from this type of colonialism.
Right.
Which is, I'm just now picking up in my 30s.
It's like, yeah. Let's just focus on the building.
Yeah, it's like a history that's more based on architecture than, you know, actual the human beings involved.
Yeah, and I also want to say real quick, I love the term Californio.
Californios?
Yeah, which is so interesting to, which now, makes sense. You
was
know.
Was that the people who, because it's, so there, like, there's a lot of confusion, like, there's a lot of confusion there, because it's like California was part of Mexico, then the Spanish
lost the war.
So first it was Spanish, then it was Mexican, then the people who were living there, what was their identity? And that was, they were Californios, which were Mexicans who had lived long enough in California, basically.
I guess it was Hispanic people native to the U.S.
And they were probably the Spanish or Mexican. Yeah, I guess it's all very confusing. We need a class on this. Maybe Professor Farragher could just
if we do an episode about this, maybe Spanish conquest of California, that could be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be great, because we really need to figure this out for ourselves. We live here. These are like these are the streets we drive on. This is the place that we've like made home. We should know how it came to be, at the very least. So do we want to change any of this? Oof. You know I'm tempted to go with Legacy of Conquest. But I do, you know. Perhaps, I mean, what are we going to let xenophobia off the hook?
They're all connected, right? I mean, I don't know if you want to like, I don't know. They're all connected. So I'm sure at some point the Legacy of Conquest, we can nail it.
Yeah.
But I'm down if you want to tweak the language, tweak xenophobia to Legacy of Conquest. Like, I think that's cool, but we could also just leave it. And now we have that term in our back pocket. It's totally up to you.
Well, there was something, I mean, to me, there's a bit of a, and I don't know if this is just a semantic or what, but there's a bit of a difference between xenophobia and this sort of superiority or white supremacy or legacy of conquest, where there's an inherent sort of power dynamic at play, as opposed to sort of more of a fear-based element. Like, I think the modern concept of, you know, immigration in general is more fear-based. They're taking our stuff, but or they're taking our jobs, etc. But I think back then, the legacy of conquest is sort of more of an overriding factor, where it's like, the Anglos are here, the Anglos are in charge, the Anglos are the powerful ones, and this sort of blatant disregard for this sort of upstart, if you will, community of Chinese people in Los Angeles, it sort of feels like it's a part of that, that sort of inherent sort of power dynamic, as opposed to a fear, more of a fear-based sort of
dynamic.
Yeah,
it's just like how they do things, it's just how we roll, guys. Also, lack of women. We should have put that up on the board. Lack of women in the West.
Yeah.
And while he was telling us all about these, like, just like what it was like, I'm like, God, just a few women like helping run a few of the places would have really helped.
I know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to think about, like, a lot of these areas at the time were, all guys.
No, and diversifying.
No, it was like,
you know?
And he used a term like a lot of them were basically just like mining communities. So it was basically like everyone had to work in these things, and then there were these sort of like brothels and different vices like gambling and stuff like that. But it was I would say maybe bro culture you could throw up there.
Well, here's what I think. I think I'm going to keep xenophobia. Well, no, I'm going to change it to the legacy of conquest because I think it is more specific, like you said, Chris. And I'm going to also change the slap. I know we had said the local government, but I think I'm going to change it to the seven policemen. I'm sorry. We got that wrong too. Not six, seven. the seven policemen that just didn't de-escalate the situation. And I think that was a contributing factor to the tradition of vigilantism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when he said that they deputized the people who were coming in and literally firing into innocent, you know, people's homes in Chinatown, that came from that group of people, the police who were supposed to make sure everyone was safe.
Yeah.
Right. But instead, they didn't.
I think with our new information, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, I'm going to call it. The seven policemen, you're getting the big slap. Legacy of conquest, you're going to the alarmist jail. Well, I mean, we couldn't have done it without Professor Farragher. Thank you so much for coming on to speak to us for this episode. And you know, we couldn't have done it without ourselves, without each other as well.
Oh, thanks to both of you.
Hey, thanks.
Okay, well, tune in next week. We're covering the Ramstein air show disaster.
Earios.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.